Welcome back to Word and Table, a bi-weekly podcast on liturgy, sacrament, and the great tradition of Christian worship and why it is vital in our world today. I'm your host, Alex Wilgus, and I am here as usual with Father Stephen Gauthier. Welcome back, Father Stephen.
Great to be back, Alex.
Father Stephen is the canon theologian of the Diocese of the Upper Midwest in the Anglican Church in North America, and he is director of formation at St. Paul's House of Formation in the Greenhouse Movement. Today, Father Stephen, you suggested a really exciting thing to do, and I'm really excited to get started on it. We're going to start actually a special series here at Word and Table over the next couple of weeks, because you brought to me that it might be a good idea to just tell the story of the first three centuries of the church, and just tell that story all the way through. Right. So today we're going to bring you the first 100 years of Christianity. Next week, we're going to do the next 100 years. And the week after that, we'll do the last 100 years. And am I right? Does that take us up to Constantine?
Yes, right. Okay. To Constantine.
Great. So I think it's a great idea to get a kind of a big picture of what the story of our faith is in its earliest days. Wouldn't you agree with that?
Oh, yeah. I think otherwise, for a lot of us, I think what can happen is imagine someone who knew a little bit about American history. They knew figures and things, but didn't have any timeline, didn't really know centuries. So you have something like a George Washington meeting Theodore Roosevelt. they're Americans. And, you know, knowing the different stages in history can help us understand, like, the different church fathers. Oh, they're in that phase.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Yeah, I often felt like that when it came to European history. You know, it's like, oh, you know, Charlemagne, and then, you know, next you have what? Philip the Fair, right? Is there time between that?
Yes, okay. There are gaps.
So we want to make sure that that you folks that we don't have any gaps here in our history. And we're not going to go into a ridiculous amount of detail.
The big themes.
Right, but we want to get the big story. So if you could, I don't know, Stephen, if you could sum up just kind of in a sentence what this first 100 years of Christianity, what happens in this first 100 years of Christianity?
The first century.
Yeah.
Normally, a century is a pretty arbitrary break, but in this case, when we look at the centuries, each of the first three centuries has a really defined characteristic. Mm-hmm. It's really helpful to remember it. And the theme of the first century really is Christianity spreads. I mean, it's amazing how fast it spreads. And that means we have the initial reaction. Everyone who comes across, we have it spreading, and we find the reaction to that spreading. That's the story of the first century.
Okay, I see. So Christianity isn't a slow start.
It
kind of goes off with a bang then, I see. Okay, yeah. Well, you know, from history classes and things, I do know that you shouldn't ever tell a historical story without talking about the context of it. So what's the world look like when Christianity rises to the world stage?
That's a good point, Alex, when it comes to the story of Christianity, because Christians for centuries thought it was a miracle that we sort of had like a perfect storm of circumstances that came into place that made this spread possible. It's hard to imagine it any other time, and they believe it's providential. So the first thing we have is, of course, the great Roman peace, the Pax Romana. Remember, the ancient world, people fought routinely. It's like, think of warlords. That's what they do. They're always pressing each other's borders. And so what we actually have started by 60, there's two centuries of expansion. We now have peace. We basically have the Mediterranean at peace.
Hmm. So this is unusual.
This is very unusual.
Okay.
This means getting around is easy. It means we're going to have people actually tied together in a way they've never been tied before, the whole Mediterranean basin. So this is an exciting thing. Judea comes within that orbit, 63 BC, about 100 years, you know, before the beginning of Christianity after Jesus, you know, that movement.
Okay, so you're saying the Roman Empire has pretty much put a stop to war in a major way throughout the Mediterranean world, and it's connected lots of people and places.
Right. I mean, navigation is safe on the Mediterranean and things. You know, people can, in a very real way, there's really communication, law and order.
Okay, got it.
The Pax, the Roman peace. People had never seen anything like it. They celebrated it.
Mm.
Another thing that helps is Jews had spread throughout, took advantage of this, had spread out with trading and things. And Jews had a had a special legal status, which Christians will profit from. Something you should know about Romans. Romans thought religion, actually they had a bad etymology for the word, religio in Latin. They thought it meant having something to do with being bound or tied. It doesn't, but they thought it did. But their idea was, it's the customs of the ancestors. And so they thought it was only logical that people who had different ancestors would have different customs. So that's why, even though Romans had to follow the Roman religion because it's our customs, they thought it was perfectly normal for Jews and logical they'd follow their own religion. And so they actually had legal status in the empire to do that. They didn't have to do things that violated their religion. That's not the Roman way.
Okay. So Rome was fairly tolerant of people's religious systems.
Right. And with the Jews, there was a special thing, again, because it was a very ancient religion. And the Romans, it's sort of like in America. Right now, more pacifistic views are popular, but like I say back, that wasn't true until the Vietnam War. Mm-hmm. But for example, in the Second World War, Hacksaw Ridge, the movie or something.
Oh, the Mel Gibson movie, right. Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Is with the idea of being a conscientious objector.
Okay, yeah.
Normally, Americans felt like, they said, well, you know, to be a conscientious objector, you had to be raised as one. They understood that and respected that. Mm-hmm. If you were a Mennonite or a Quaker, that's how you were raised. And America's about that.
Sure.
But some good Lutheran boy or Catholic boy who decides he doesn't believe in war was looked at, whoa.
Yeah.
So the Romans had the special exemptions they give to Jews exactly because they belong to an ancient religion. Mm-hmm. And we're going to profit from that. And also it meant a lot of people got intrigued by the Jewish religion as it spread. Mm-hmm. The belief in the one God and the holiness and things was very attractive. Which brings me to something else people should know who don't know about Roman religion. Roman religion is nothing at all like we think of a religion. We think of religion as somehow being involved with the deeper issues of life and with goodness. That's not Roman religion. For example, you could become a god. Remember, emperors could die and could... The gods were sort of one level above us.
Okay.
We think of angels or something. You know, they were a level... And that's why their behavior was not a shock to Romans.
Okay.
Their behavior was hardly angelic.
Okay.
And so actually the best way in popular terms to understand Roman religion, it's more like living in a neighborhood controlled by the mob.
Okay.
Now, mobsters, if they live in your neighborhood, first of all, you got to respect them.
Yeah.
You do not diss a mobster. You're in trouble.
Uh-huh.
They come into your restaurant. You, of course, give them free coffee. You don't have them a bill, etc.
Try and stay on their good side.
And they're expected to cover you. Mm-hmm. If they're in your neighborhood, the protection rackets. They're expected to do their job. Mm. And that's sort of how Romans looked at the gods. Now, you might ask for a favor. You might ask for a favor, but it's sort of risky. Because getting involved with the gods more than staying on their good side is dangerous.
Oh, okay, interesting, yeah.
So this is not something you look for fine personal fulfillments, but by this time, people, because of peace, when people have the luxury of being at peace, they start thinking of those things. And so people are looking elsewhere. So the typical place, if you're a Roman or a Greek, to look was never religion, it was philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
Philosophy is going to look for meaning for life and morals. How then shall I live?
So like knowledge more than the gods are going to tell you how to live.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Not at all. Matter of fact, the only connection with morality with the Roman gods is sort of the universe would crash if certain things weren't observed.
I see.
But naphos meant taking one of those right relationships and destroying it. For example, killing a parent. Well, that would turn the universe on its head.
Okay, yeah.
So that was something the Furies would come after you
so
for.
So it was sort of like the divines were like maintainers of some kind of cosmic order.
Exactly.
Yeah, okay.
But in a very limited sense. But your normal sexual morality was utterly of no interest to the gods.
Yeah.
another thing is we have neo-paganism. Neo-paganism, it comes about the same time as Christianity, is no educated Roman actually believed the stories, but they really loved their traditions.
Mm-hmm.
And they were good stories. And they said, maybe we can interpret them in a more philosophical way as being parables.
I see.
And so they began actually assigning meanings to these, moral meanings that are really symbolic of this or of that.
Mm-hmm.
That's called neo-paganism. We had mystery cults. The Romans loathed this. They called it superstition. Is they'd have people from the East, especially like the cult of Mithra.
Oh, yeah. I've heard of that.
Things like that would come through the cult of Isis. And also we just had a lot of people attracted to Judaism.
Yeah.
Now they couldn't become Jews. Well, you could, but it was too big a price. Because remember, Judaism at that time, to become a Jew meant you could never stay in your family's house again. You could never eat with them.
Yeah.
That was too big. And circumcision, which was not a private matter in the Roman world, people would see in a world filled with public nudity. Remember,
sure.
This was not a, like boxers or briefs. Everyone would know. And so those, so what we have is everyone's looking for a better way, whether it be philosophy or neo-paganism. Let's reinterpret, put philosophy on the religion or something. Mystery cults, looking for Judaism. A lot of people went that way. Everyone's looking for something more. Thing that happened, last thing here in this conflict, is suddenly we have a language everybody can speak. In my own lifetime, I've seen the difference, like with the growth of English. I'm not ancient of days, but I'm old. And when I was young, when you go places, you'd have to choose between a variety of world languages that, you know, we call vehicular languages, language people use to get around with each other who spoke smaller languages. So you typically have English, French, German would be the classic things. Where the you do one of those. And now it's always English.
Okay.
Anywhere you go, everyone can agree. And it's amazing how many people know enough English to do business with you around the world.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what happened with Greek.
Greek,
suddenly, even in Rome, everyone is using this as a practical way to get around.
Now, why did I think that Romans spoke Latin?
They did, but they had huge admiration for the Greeks.
Mm-hmm.
And so for educated Romans, they wanted their kids to learn Greek natively.
Okay,
they were proud of speaking Latin. They wouldn't want the kids just to speak Greek. But they did, and so actually educated Romans were actually raised by tutors who raised them speaking, they spoke Greek natively.
Oh, wow, okay. Okay.
And they were bilingual.
Yeah.
The upper classes. And other people always knew business Greek, like you would with English now. You might not read novels and things, but if you run a hotel, you can basically say how much it is a night and just...
Sure. Yeah.
I'm sorry, the plumbing doesn't work. Basic things.
Okay, so we've got peace. So we have Jews having a special religious status. More on that later. We've got a lot of interest in philosophy, you know.
A meaning to life.
Right, meaning to life. There's kind of a reevaluation of pagan myths. There's all these strange mystery cults. And then there's some Romans who can get as close as they can to converting to Judaism. And then we've got Greek as the common language of the empire. So there's the container.
And also Philo, remember, the Jewish, great Jewish writer, actually wrote a lot of those things to show people that the Bible was deeper than it might appear from a Roman perspective, that these stories had deep philosophical meanings.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So he really presents that in a way, but people found the monotheism very attractive.
It's a little bit like that Jordan Peterson guy, right? I've Philo, like the way that he talks about the Bible is having these deep psychological meanings.
Exactly.
Sort of like Philo, right? Like, yeah.
Because the initial Roman idea was these weren't as good as our stories.
Sure. So it sounds like we've got an empire at peace with a lot of people who have the time to begin wondering. And so we've got a lot of circulation around Yahweh. That's what I'm taking from this. Does that sound right?
Right. We have the means, an interest, and we have the means. It's like looking for a customer. You know, you basically have a need out there and a way to meet that need.
Okay, so let's talk about the gospel.
Obviously. Well, yeah, you can not talk too much about that.
Right.
It goes out really fast.
Yeah.
And one of the things, of course, as we know the scriptures tell us, is it certainly wasn't our plan.
Mm.
Is the first real, initially we go out to Samaria, you know, with Philip and things. But how does it really get out fast is after the death of Stephen, there's a persecution.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's the resentment against this. And so people are basically leave for prudential reasons, but they start sharing the gospel where they go.
Right, right, right.
And so, with all the wrong people. Right, remember we said they actually start talking to Gentiles and things.
Mm-hmm,
you know,
mm-hmm.
they're starting to share the gospel. They go to Cyprus, they go to Antioch, they start going around and sharing the gospel.
So really persecution is what kind of kicks the anthill, and we start going out and the gospel starts to spread.
Yeah. Right, it was divine that way. So we have it initially to Samaria, then it gets to the coastline with Phoenicia and Cyprus, the island of Cyprus. Then it goes out, gets to Antioch.
So can you tag these places in modern geography? So we say Phoenicia, where's that?
Phoenicia would be the coast of modern Israel and then the Gaza Strip. That's Phoenicia, the line of the Phoenicians were sea-bearing peoples. It's basically the coastal area of today's Israel.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And is Cyprus Greece area?
No, Cyprus is right off. If you just go straight across from that coast, there are two big islands. Crete is that big long island south of Turkey. There's a little compact island south of that, due west of Israel.
Okay, so...
And that's Cyprus.
So Cyprus is modern-day Cyprus.
Okay. It is Cyprus,
Got it. Okay, mm-hmm. And Antioch, is that Turkey? Is that...
Antioch, Syria.
Syria, that's right. Yeah.
Okay. I mean, I'm trying to think. I think it would still be in... Antioch would be in Syria.
Okay, got it. Okay.
It might be in the very far... smallest... I have to check that up. It might be in that southern... There's a little line that goes down in Turkey at the far end. It was in Roman Syria.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But it's right there. It's in the north part of the coast. Tyre, Sidon, and Antioch are all up north.
Okay, got it. Great. Okay, so what happens next?
Well, then we have the missionary journeys of Paul.
Okay.
Which are remarkably successful. He gets into Asia Minor, which is all Greek at that time. Remember, Turkey comes, eight centuries later.
Yeah.
So it's all Greek.
So Paul's the guy who kicks off the persecution. He helps kick off that first persecution.
Right.
All the Christians spread out and start sharing the gospel, and then God goes back for Paul.
Yeah, there's a divine irony
that
Paul is this chosen instrument, and of course he has his first, he brings the gospel to Asia Minor, which is very important, because remember, one of the central Greek presences is of the western area there. He starts out in the eastern area, the east, southeast, mm-hmm. but he then gets to Greece itself.
Yeah.
So he has three missionary journeys. And actually, independently of Paul, we know the gospel got to Rome.
Yeah.
Before Paul. Remember, Paul's the only letter he writes to a church he hadn't founded.
Oh, that's right. He didn't found it, did he?
But we also know that it was there by 50 AD. How do we know that? Because we have a Roman writer, Suetonius, who mentions the fact that the Emperor Claudius said he expelled the Jews from Rome. We even mentioned in the New Testament.
Mm-hmm.
Why'd he expel them? They kept fighting over this guy named Crestos.
Okay.
That's what he tells us.
So we've got a letter.
We assume that's Christ.
I see. So we've got a letter sort of...
The Roman historian Suetonius tells us.
Offhandedly speaking to this Christ fellow that everyone's so mad about.
Yeah, so that's why we had to get... The Jews kept fighting. We just had this... Claudius said, get out of the city. All you do is get into fights.
Okay.
And they come back by the time there's a church by the time of Paul. And actually, we have evidence that Paul made it to Spain. You know, he said he wanted to do that in the New Testament, but we actually have at least, we have in Clement of Rome tells us that the tradition was he actually did make it.
I see. Okay.
So it's really spreading out that way. It's pretty much all the, you might say, well, that's all west. We get to Rome, but there's not much really beyond that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The Roman Empire is more like a federation of cities.
Yeah.
And because of the way the Mediterranean, if you look at the Mediterranean, there aren't many good ports in the west.
Yeah.
The good ports are in the east. And so all you have is Rome and you have Carthage,
mm-hmm.
but there's not much really west of there. And so the heart of the Roman Empire is in the eastern Mediterranean.
Right. So gospel spreads, Paul, God seems to have the purpose for Paul to spread the gospel, whether he's persecuting people or not.
And when he's arrested,
when
more ways to spread the gospel, he goes to Rome and starts talking about the new Jewish community in Rome.
Yeah.
The Jews are back and he goes and talks to them.
Okay, so at this point, this is a Jewish phenomenon, right? So this is a thoroughly Jewish religion that's being shared with Gentile communities.
That's how it's seen.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of, as Josephus tells us, there were a lot of different types of Jews.
Yeah.
Judaism was sort of like we talk about Christian, well, there are all sorts of denominations. There were different types of Jews, and the initial impression was Christianity was one of those Jewish groups.
I see. Kind of
that
like
was the general feel.
Like the Essenes or the Pharisees.
Pharisees, the Sadducees, Zealots, etc.
We've got these Christians.
It's one of those groups.
Uh-huh.
But rapidly things go sour. We see the arrest of Peter and the other apostles. You know, obviously they had stepped on the wrong feet. The martyrdom of Stephen.
Mm-hmm.
And this brings something we should understand that's going to be a bad feel here with Jews. There are two types of Jews. There are Jews who actually lived in the Holy Land who remain very Semitic. They spoke Aramaic, which is very similar to Hebrew. They lived in the Holy Land, etc.
Yeah.
It's sort of like thinking of Italians and Italian Americans.
Sure, sure, sure. Yeah.
Others had gone and really become more Greek than they were Jewish. They might have kept their faith. Remember, they had to translate the Bible into Greek so Jews could read the Bible.
Okay, yeah.
Those
yeah.
Hellenistic Jews.
I see, okay.
And so they were sort of suspicious of, remember, Pharisees say, we really have to keep apart to save Judaism.
Yeah.
And these Hellenistic Jews were still...
They'd spread out.
Jews, but wow, they acted a lot like Gentiles.
So they kind of gone native.
Yeah, but, okay. Yeah, they did, but they were always suspicious that they might be bringing the virus with them.
Mm-hmm.
And so the initial persecution that tells us in Acts of the Apostles is they had no trouble with the apostles, who were all Jews. I mean, in the sense of a Jew's Jew. I mean, somebody, you know, from Aramaic speakers, etc. But Stephen here was a Hellenistic Jew. The name Stephanos is Greek.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is Greek. You know, here's a Hellenistic Jew, and he's the first one who's martyred. Saul persecutes the church. But really things go south when, for two reasons, Hellenists really start embracing the gospel.
Mm-hmm.
Because they live in a world filled with people who don't follow these things. And then Gentiles, when they actually decide that Gentiles can become Christians without becoming Jews... This seems as an existential threat to Judaism.
I see. Yeah, yeah.
You mean you're going to get rid of the law, you know, you don't follow the law of Moses? So this really starts raising Jewish cackles. You're not a Jewish group.
Right,
you know,
right,
there's
right.
The seeing that. But things really break up because there's a lot of suspicion. But everything gets bad with the Jewish revolt that leads in 66 to 70 AD with the destruction.
Big one. Yeah.
Remember, the Lord promised, and this is why even people who are very much unbelievers believe that Jesus predicted the destruction of Jerusalem. Why? Because we know historically that what did Christians do when the Romans armies came? The whole Christian community left.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh.
Which is not the logical thing you would do. Is remember, normally you go to cities. Jerusalem was supposed to be impregnable.
So
it was a long siege.
You want to barricade yourself in.
Barricade yourself in. They left because Jesus told them to leave. When you see these things coming, flee. They did. We know for a fact they did flee.
Wow.
Later on, after the event, people looked upon Christians as having let them down.
I see.
In our worst moment, you guys left.
You gave us up.
So there's some really bad feelings. And we come to the point that increasingly, by the end of the century, Jews are looking upon Christians as not really being Jews at all. Especially with all these Gentiles there, and they don't follow the law. No, they're not circumcised. And also Christians are starting to look upon Judaism as being, maybe they're more of another religion than part of us.
Yeah.
Who's getting that? And there's a lot of bitterness starts. You see this in the book of Revelation. Remember, Jews enjoyed a special privilege. They didn't have to worship the emperor because they were Jews.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what happens when your Jewish neighbors come to the Roman authorities and say, wait a second, these people aren't Jews?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That means this actually was more than not being nice. This is a matter that this put Christians at a real risk.
I see.
So in Acts, remember in Revelation, we have that letter say, these people who claim to be Jews but are not, the synagogue of Satan?
Yeah.
This is in a town where that kind of thing probably happened.
I see.
Is that, you know, who is the real Jew? And they'd probably been challenged, you're not Jews, you can't claim the Jewish privileges. And they're saying, we're the real Jews, we are actually the fulfillment of Moses in these things.
Sure, sure. I'll bet to a Roman to a Roman procurator, you'd probably be pretty confused.
You confuse me with someone who cares.
Yeah.
Remember, that's the constant theme the Romans have, remember, like in Acts of the Apostles, is I thought there was a real crime here.
Yeah.
Is this about
yeah.
religious stuff?
Okay.
That's very much the Roman attitude. The Romans had a very live, when I explained Roman religion, had a very live and let live
kind
attitude
ethic,
about
yeah.
actual religious belief.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. Okay, so, but we do get Roman persecutions against Christians, right? So they've got a live and let live thing, but what leads to that?
Well, not really. Initially, what we have is that there's some periodic response, some negative response, like we have at Ephesus, you know. But the empire as a whole will only change its attitude gradually. We're going to actually find that actual government persecution will be in the third century. So normally it's more like pogroms. Remember, like in Russia, one of the things is, you know, periodically enemies would get upset with the local Jews and raid the village. Right. It's much more that nature in the early century.
Kind of like mob violence.
Yeah, people get upset, especially because Christians often make fun of the gods and things.
Sure.
And remember, you don't... When you're talking about mobsters, if you think about, you know, in the neighborhood, this was not good. This could get all of us into trouble.
I see.
So sometimes their attitude towards was considered to be anti-religious, because their view is religious people respected all religions.
Okay.
And Jews often made it a point, or rather Christians made it a point not to respect the gods.
Got it. So Christians are more at risk of setting off riots than they're living in some kind of police state.
In the first century, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And there aren't that, and what you have is, we do know with Nero, it's an unusual thing in the first century. Because Nero, with the burning of Rome, he's immediately suspected. I wonder why. But in any event, he finds it convenient. These people are unpopular because they're considered to be anti-religious. The constant accusation of Christians are atheists, meaning that they reject the gods.
I see.
Not that they believe in the one God, but they just seem to be anti-religious.
Yeah.
Which is dangerous to people, because there are collective punishments from the gods and things.
Right, because the whole vision of order thing.
Like the whole vision of order.
Maybe if things are going wrong, then maybe it's these guys that are disrespecting the gods.
If you're in a mob neighborhood, you don't want somebody else's kid keying their car.
Okay, that makes sense. Oh, man.
So what we have here, we have Nero, but that's an unusual thing as far as actual state. And also Domitian, there appeared to be some small persecution relatively compared to what will happen later on. But normally we can say the first century, there's very little in the way of organized problems with Christianity. It tends to be local resentment at Christian attitudes and things.
Okay, I see. Okay, so that's what's going on in the empire. But what's going on internally? How does the church start to develop itself in this time? Because these aren't just random bands of enthusiasts, right? Like, we have an actual church here.
We have a church, yes. And they're very conscious of being one. These were not just people interested in Jesus doing their thing. Mm. What we have is traveling church planters. We call them apostles. We had traveling prophets. The book of the Didache talks us about, you know, how do you deal when these people show up, how many days they can stay, that kind of thing.
Right. Yeah, I remember that. There's something in there about...
3 days.
Yeah, it's 3 days.
And then a day's food supply.
And you should be suspicious of a prophet that prophesies specifically in order to benefit himself.
Yeah, the saying is, a prophet doesn't set his own table. Meaning, if I came to you as a prophet, said, Alex, God has told me you have to give me half your money.
Yeah.
So theoretically, a prophecy, if it means the prophet personally benefits, is suspect.
Got it, yeah.
But no, the church life is going to settle down very quickly into much more ordered form. But at first, it's again like the Wild West, and people are going out there with church planters and prophets and things. It's very mobile, but it'll quickly, as we'll see in the second center, settle down to a very, very structured form we'd recognize today.
Okay.
In many ways.
But right now we've got evangelization, we've got itinerant church planters and things.
And they're setting churches. These aren't just people with personal beliefs in Jesus. It's always they're establishing churches.
Sure. One of the sources we're name dropping here is the Didache. We've had an episode on before,
yes.
But kind of if you want a little window into what everyday life was like in this period, it's kind of like a little handbook that stitches together.
Because you had new churches, like the Greenhouse movie, you had to say, okay, now that you have a church, here's what you do.
Yeah,
like you have to baptize. So how do you do that?
Yeah. What happens? How do we do this? How do we do that? You know, it's a really, I love it.
It's a fascinating book. Yeah.
Beyond the Bible, that's the one I probably go back to the most. It just, there's a lot in there.
That's good. And it's actually very interesting to historians because, as we mentioned, the Didache episode, it appears, again, this is an era of no copyrights.
Yeah.
And so people, if you found something good and everything was by hand, you just put it in. So it looks like there's some earlier material that's been sewn together.
Right.
There are good things you need, like we now Xerox this, Xerox that.
Yeah, and then stitch it all together.
Stitch it together and say, this is the church manual.
Got it. Cool. Oh, great. Yeah, well, your main source for this would be the Didache, but also some of the other apostolic fathers date to this period, right? What other sources are we looking at?
Well, Didache is unique. The Didache is the only thing that really comes, because the next in time really that the apostolic fathers will be with Ignatius at the beginning of the second century. Okay, we'll talk about him, and then Clement will be in the second century and things. Yeah, but the Didache was certainly written by 125, but probably, I'm with a group that thinks it's much earlier. I think it's probably no later, like about 95 or so.
Okay.
I think there's good evidence for that. But it's very much, and it has earlier documents.
Right.
So it's the only one of the apostolic fathers that is really, really good.
Yeah.
That shouldn't surprise us, because by definition, apostolic father is somebody who studied, is the first or second generation from the apostles.
Uh-huh.
The people to whom the apostles preached, or those people preached to the next group.
Yeah.
And we still have John writing in the 90s.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, so we're hardly, the apostles are still around in the sense of John. Yeah.
So we're looking at the New Testament. We're looking
New
at
Testament,
the Didache. We're looking at, we're looking at, outside of the Christian sphere, we're looking at Philo. We're looking at,
Philo's earlier. Yeah.
Philo's a little earlier. Yeah. Okay. Got it. Okay. Great.
So at the end of the century, what we have is basically, amazingly so, is out what would seem to have been a filler article in a newspaper about somebody being crucified in Palestine. Suddenly, it's all over the world. I mean, there are Christians, you're finding them everywhere, and it's and we're getting a reaction. The Jewish reaction is, it was initially, well, I guess it's another kind of Jew, but again, for various reasons, things are that's not the truth at the end of the century, and it'll get worse. And then we have, with the Romans, saying some intermittent persecutions. But basically, it's more a local affair. The Roman Empire is not officially reacting in any way. There are no official persecutions and things of Christians as such.
Right. So maybe the takeaway here is the Book of Acts is not lying. The Gospel is a success here.
Oh, yeah. There's no, historically, there's no question.
No question.
The word everyone's talking about. Yeah, it says, yeah.
Yeah, great. Well, there you go. There's the first 100 years of the church. Great. Well, looking forward to doing the next 100 next week. Stephen, anything else that you've got for us on this first century of the Christian faith?
No, I think it's exciting. We're just, you know, by the end of the century, we're on the cusp of everything really moving big. The second century will be an amazing century, and a lot of people will have a lot more all sorts of tremendous sources to draw upon.
Great. Well, thanks so much, Father Stephen, and thank you for listening to Word and Table. We'll be back next week this time with more on the history of the church and more on liturgy, sacrament, and the great tradition of Christian worship. Thanks for listening.